Morning People Beware.
I cannot take your show. It's just, you know, you guys are just too peppy.
Too peppy? At 6 in the morning, do you really want some caffeine-addled news voices in your ear?
Guys are just too peppy.
How's this?
Too peppy.
Tragically peppy. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, June 12th. A look at your most passionate feedback about our new public radio program. Stay tuned. Also, U.S. intentions in Iraq, sorting out the reality from all the posturing. Is the fix in the NBA? Influential turkeys in Ireland, and a discussion of the end of food. Really? That and all the news. Threats of floods and tornadoes are badgering wide parts of the Midwest. In the hills of western Iowa, a twister killed 4 people and injured more than 40 others when it roared through a Boy Scout ranch. One of the Boy Scouts speaking to CNN said it happened very quickly.
There's no warning. The weather radio wasn't saying anything that was useful, and if we weren't watching, just Boy Scouts being prepared.
Kansas was also hit by a tornado, smashing dozens of homes and businesses in the town of Chapman. At least one person was killed. Jim Johnson, the former Fannie Mae CEO leading Barack Obama's vice presidential search, resigned abruptly yesterday after mounting questions about his home mortgage deals. Just a day after defending him, Obama says he accepted the resignation because the issue was becoming a distraction to his campaign.
Today marks 1 month since a 7.9 magnitude earthquake hit China's Sichuan province, and police are on alert. They're concerned about protests from grieving parents who are demanding answers about the construction of collapsed schools. The U.S. Defense Department is standing by yesterday's air attack in Afghanistan that killed 11 Pakistani soldiers on the border between the two countries. Pakistan's military spokesman, Major General Attar Abbas, says the attack has created tension between the two allies.
From our side, this was a completely unprovoked and cowardly act, and we directly blame the coalition forces for this violent act.
The coalition in Afghanistan will release a video of the attack later today.
NASA has launched a new telescope into space that could revolutionize our understanding of the universe. Scientists hope the $590 million glass telescope will reveal more about dark matter, supermassive black holes, and powerful gamma rays.
I want to know more about black holes. In a deal that could create the world's largest brewer, Belgium-based InBev has made an offer of more than $46 billion to buy Anheuser-Busch. Oil jumped $5 a barrel yesterday to settle above 136. The Nikkei dropped sharply today. The Dow fell 200 points or more yesterday. It begins at 12,083. The S&P begins at 1,335. So what we're thinking about today is restrictions on the internet. How would you restrict internet speech or internet activities? And what would those restrictions look like? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're going to be talking about it in the context of child pornography a little
bit. Are there some things that are just so vile that we should restrict the First Amendment and content online?
And will there be implications if that is done? Also, we're going to share some of your most negative and fabulously negative feedback later on in the show, so stay tuned.
Because we listen to it all.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. In just a moment, we're going to go live to the terrible aftermath of some pretty devastating tornadoes in Iowa. But first, our focus begins this morning with the endgame in Iraq. It's part of the campaign debate. Statements from John McCain and Barack Obama are talking about the endgame. But what do those mean in light of negotiations that are going on right now in Baghdad? discussions that are taking place this week in Europe and in Washington. Sometime before the end of the year, the U.S. is going to have to disclose its precise intentions long-term in Iraq. The U.N. resolution that allows U.S. troops and personnel to stay, fight, and operate there expires in less than 6 months. A new White House deal that reportedly will keep U.S. troops there long-term is in big trouble at home and in Iraq. What's Iraq going to look like in 5 years? Is it going to look like South Korea and Japan with more or less permanent military bases? Or is it going to look like Vietnam, where we just packed up and went home? Lawrence Korb was an Undersecretary of State for Defense in the Reagan administration. He's now at the Center for American Progress. He speaks to us this morning from Oklahoma City. Larry, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, can you provide some clarity here? The Iraqi government is supposedly opposed to the U.S. position on what the long-term arrangement is going to be in Iraq. There's a lot of dispute over whether there are going to be permanent bases in Iraq. And then there's this whole question of the U.S. demanding that personnel, both military and subcontractors, get judicial immunity on a kind of an open-ended basis. What are the sticking points in these negotiations?
Well, the Iraqis basically want to be treated as a sovereign country, and they say that if American troops or foreign troops are here, they should be here under conditions that we set. For example, that if an American soldier or a private contractor were to violate what they see as Iraqi law, then the Iraqis could prosecute them rather than, say, for example, military people under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or private contractors would be prosecuted back here at home rather than being prosecuted in Iraq. The next question is, what would be the rules governing American military operations? Would they have to check with the Iraqi government, or could they go after what they perceive as terrorists without checking with the Iraqis? And so those are the sticking points. The Americans obviously do not want to see our people subject to Iraqi law, nor do they want to actually coordinate operations with the Iraqis, because they're concerned that the Iraqi government is infiltrated by some of the groups that they're going after.
How much does the fact that George Bush and Nour al-Maliki are lame duck outgoing executives, how much does that complicate these negotiations?
Well, it certainly complicates it for us, because the Iraqis basically say if we go and we do all of this, or we make what they perceive as concessions, and then the next president comes in and he decides he doesn't want them, then we're going to have to renegotiate this thing all over again. And the interesting thing is they really do pay attention to our elections, and they know, for example, the different positions of Senator McCain and Senator Obama on this.
Well, they're probably paying attention to the president, too. He's in Europe, and he made this comment yesterday that I wonder if you could react to, and it's about the subject of whether there are going to be permanent bases that are actually being built now in Iraq. Here's President George W. Bush.
You read stories, perhaps in your newspaper, that the U.S. is planning all kinds of permanent bases in Iraq. That's an erroneous story. The Iraqis will learn it's erroneous, too.
Larry, the Iraqis, of course, are witness to the enormous amount of construction that's taken place in Iraq. What kind of clarity can you give to that statement from the president?
Well, again, it's a permanent basis in the eye of the beholder. Technically speaking, our bases in Japan and Germany can be considered not permanent, because they could be closed at some future time. And that, of course, is the question: who will decide when this base should be closed or remain open? And so the Iraqis contend that the United States has asked for 200 facilities in the country, and our people are saying no, we think we can get by with 50. But if you see those bases, I mean, they look very, very, very permanent.
Huh. And so it's between 200 and 50, even though the president is saying zero?
Well, he's saying no permanent, but obviously we have bases there. And, of course, another sticking point is control of the airspace. The United States wants to control the airspace, they say, too, so we can fly in supplies and people, and also use our air power against suspected terrorists. The Iraqis are afraid that we would then use that to fly over Iraq and attack Iran.
You know, we haven't even gotten to the issue of Iran, but I want to close with this question, because the Iraq-Iran relationship, of course, is a huge deal in all of this. But as we evaluate the statements from John McCain and Barack Obama over the next few months, talking about getting out or not getting out, is there any way that they can speak with clarity on this until these issues are resolved by this administration, Larry?
It'd be very difficult, because when the UN mandate expires, Chapter 7, which says Iraq is a threat to security and so therefore we can occupy the country, there's no legal basis for us being there, and that expires 1 January, and the new president doesn't come in till the 20th of January. So you have to have some resolution. My guess is you would probably extend the UN resolution for at least 6 months.
All right, Lawrence Korb, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Lawrence Korb is a former U.S. Undersecretary of Defense and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He spoke to us from Oklahoma City.
Another round of deadly weather hit the Midwest last night. In Iowa, at least 4 people were killed and 40 injured at a Boy Scout camp. Another tornado in Kansas has killed at least 1 person. Towns across the region are dealing with the worst flooding in 15 years, causing collapsed bridges, overflowing sewers, and concerns about stressed dams and levees. The National Weather Service and the Storm Prediction Center say more storms are likely today in some of the same areas from Kansas to Wisconsin. Joining us now for more about the Boy Scout camp in Iowa is Beth Trejo from the Red Cross, who spent some time with the families. Beth, good morning.
Good morning.
Can you tell us what was happening last night?
Well, it was a long night for everyone last night. Those victims and the Boy Scouts that were involved, as well as their families and their loved ones that were waiting on word as to where their child was and what the situation was. So it was difficult for everybody. The Red Cross had mental health workers in there. We had some spiritual counselors in there to come in and to help the families. They would sit and listen and talk and really provide someone to talk to in their time of need. And so during that time, I did get a chance to talk to a couple of the boys affected, and their stories were just remarkable. They were some of the most courageous and inspiring young men I have ever come into contact with, and it was really interesting to hear what they had to say.
And we're talking about campers between the ages of 13 and 18 years old. They were at a leadership training camp, and we've seen reports this morning that a search and rescue team has been deployed. Are some of the Boy Scouts or any of the adults who were with them, is anyone missing?
Well, from what I have heard, I don't think that anybody is particularly missing. They just want to make sure that there wasn't any additional campers in the area or somebody that they were not aware of. But that is just what some of the reports around here have noted.
Lloyd Rothstein, the president of the Boy Scouts of Mid-America Council, he spoke a few minutes earlier today. Let's listen to what he said.
Today is a tragic day for scouting. We want to express our deepest sympathies to the families and to all those affected by this tragedy.
And Beth, it's a very difficult and sad time for the Boy Scouts, but also all over Iowa people have been really hit by these storms. What's happening now today?
Well, we have some storms going on throughout our 5 states, and we've had some tornadoes and flooding, and we're just trying to keep everyone safe and keep up on those relief efforts. We have chapters all over the country and those in the Midwest that are responding to that, and so we're just providing the relief and getting the help as it's needed.
Beth, quickly before we go, you mentioned that the boys that you spoke with were so courageous and so remarkable. What one story that you were told by the boys really sort of is an emblem of that for you?
Well, one of the boys, who was an older boy in the camp, told me a story about how he, as the tornado was coming through, they had very little time, and so they got under and they ducked for cover, and as the wind blew, he helped hold the other boys down, literally, by grabbing their arms. And it's amazing how one person can take action so quickly and possibly save the lives of so many.
Beth Trejo from the Red Cross, thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you well.
Thank you.
Beth is in Sioux City, Iowa. Boy, that's an amazing story.
And there's just more storms predicted today. We should also add there were tornadoes last night, not only in Kansas and Iowa, but in southern Minnesota and eastern Nebraska. They touched down, but no injuries reported from those two spots.
Bad weather.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. You know, it's a big meal of headlines this week. Food is a newsmaker. From tomato salmonella outbreaks, beef riots in South Korea, the price of corn up 51% this year, food riots in Haiti, earlier in Egypt, inflation in food and commodities all over the globe, an expected 5% jump in U.S. food prices, highest since 1990, oil prices spiking, water shortages, rationing of rice, 33 countries at risk of social unrest because of food, food, all because of food. Paul Roberts, author of The End of Food, writer, journalist, are we reaching some sort of critical point here?
Well, it certainly feels like the world is ending, you know, in terms of food. It's like, you know, every time you turn on the TV or look at the newspaper, more bad news about food. And I think, you know, we've got a sort of a perfect storm of events going on here. We've got some natural disasters. You got drought. We've got wet spring keeping farmers from planting. We've also got some bad policy going on. We've got biofuels sucking up a lot of grain, taking it out of the food market, putting it into fuel markets. We've got China, you know, a lot of people getting richer, eating meat. And then we've got, you know, safety concerns. We've got a food system that seems to be letting bugs in. So,
well, let's talk for a bit. We look at the slices of this, you know, virtually every morning. Adora and I are talking about, you know, some sort of slice of this. But your book is really all about trying to take it from a macro view and sort of swallow, if I can say that, the real big dynamics that are pushing food surplus, food scarcity, food sort of environmental safety problems. How do you take this on in the way that you've done it? And you've got a provocative title, certainly, The End of Food.
Well, I mean, clearly we have a system that we've designed, sort of put together over the last century, and the idea was to sort of produce as much food as possible, lowest cost, you know, maximum convenience and variety. And it, you know, was working fairly well for most of the last century. And then in the last, say, decade, we start to see some signs that it's overheating, and that some of the sort of concepts may have been flawed. You know, basically we're trying to make food like any other consumer product, you know, TV or car. We want to produce it, you know, maximum number of units coming out to lower the cost, and we want to be able to distribute it rapidly. And that works great, you know, for an inanimate object like a TV set. It doesn't work so well for food is what we're discovering.
Why not? And are we talking about just the U.S. market, or are you talking about globally?
Well, it begins in the U.S. market. We sort of invent the model. It goes global. And why not? I mean, it's if you want to build cars, then you'd like what you want to do is centralize your production in huge factories to lower your per unit cost. You want to be able to source your raw materials from whichever supplier is selling it the cheapest that day. You want to be able to start and stop your assembly line, switch from SUVs to pickup trucks depending on the market, and then you want to take the finished product and distribute it as rapidly as possible. Works great for trucks and TV sets, doesn't work so great for food. With food, if you try all that, which we do, say in the meat business, mm-hmm. or produce, as soon as a problem enters the system, a pathogen, for example, you may have a, you know, say spinach or hamburger in a consumer's home and in their stomach before health officials even know there was an outbreak.
So centralized food production means centralized pest production, centralized environmental contaminant production. When you look at the New York Times yesterday, the headline, the picture on the front, you saw this, Adora, the millions of people in the street freaked out about American beef causing perhaps the South Korean government to fall. What do you think when you see that picture?
Well, two things. I think that food is a flashpoint. You know, whether you don't have enough of it and you're rioting because you're hungry, or whether you feel that your government is, you know, sacrificing your food safety in order to, you know, have a trade deal with the United States. I mean, the actual likelihood that we're going to have mad cow, be afflicted by mad cow, is very slight. But I think what's represented there is frustration by a population that their government's, you know, putting trade policy above public safety.
And when you talk about pathogens going through the system very quickly before they can get caught, is that just a question of setting up the safety guards, or what is the alternative?
Well, the FDA is now struggling with that very question. You know, they've just announced a $275 million initiative where they're going to try to prevent the outbreaks that are now causing so much trouble in the tomato market. And the problem there is that, yes, they can increase the number of inspectors, they can improve the standards that the companies use, but until they fix the underlying system, which is this sort of, you know, mass production, low cost, rapid distribution, these problems are going to keep coming back. You know, you can put more inspectors there, but if you're, you know, basically trying to mix ever larger batches of hamburger and distribute them to ever more, you know, consumers, you're going to have the, you know, risk of pathogen outbreak.
Let's shift to the question of supply for just a moment and maybe talk about solutions if we have time. In 2006, 800 million people on the planet were hungry, but a billion were overweight. Seems like the people who aren't hungry are winning. Is that a good view of the system or not?
Well, I mean, up until recently, you know, people described food insecurity or hunger as a distribution problem. We had plenty of calories. We just didn't have the system in place to get the calories to those who needed them. Now we've still got those distribution problems. We still have political instability, bad roads in developing nations. But on top of that, we have some scarcity. We have, you know, grain reserves that have been taken down by a number of events. We began by talking about, you know, ethanol droughts. So we have a true scarcity problem, which we haven't faced for about a half century.
And this is really sort of, for a half century there hasn't been scarcity problems.
Not globally. We've always hunger has been a regional problem. It's been, you know, it's been specific to say sub-Saharan Africa or India, and the rest of the world's been able to pitch in. We haven't seen global grain reserves this low for quite some time, and now people are saying, okay, now is that just a temporary thing? Is that just because we had the drought? Is the market going to, in other words, will the market come in and fix this, or is this a longer-term problem?
And you know, the parallel to oil is actually a little chilling. I mean, when the oil prices spike, who becomes the enemy? The producers, the companies and the producers of oil, the OPEC nations, for instance. In this particular case, if food becomes scarce, the centralized producers like the United States and other big agricultural producers become the enemy, and we're seeing that in South Korea.
Well, 2 points. First of all, you know, there are alternatives for oil. There's no alternative for food. Okay, and the second thing is, this is a very energy-intensive food system. You know, we all know that, you know, it takes a lot of oil to grow food and distribute it. But keep in mind, this system was designed for oil at $15 a barrel. Really, this was the
system. This food system?
You know, absolutely.
Really?
This was
a
system designed in the 70s and 80s. Really, the system we have now really emerged in the 70s and 80s when oil was dirt cheap. And that's why we had global, that's why we had, we're flying in, you know, produce from Chile. That's why we can ship grain all around the world. We're still using that system.
Wow.
We modified it barely, but now we're facing oil that's nearly 10 times that price.
It's a new change. Well, we're going to get the headlines here in a minute. Paul, you'll come back. You're on a book tour right now, but you'll come back.
I'd be glad to.
We'll have a whole show with Paul. Paul Roberts is the author of The End of Food. There's a provocative title. And The End of Oil.
I can't believe that the whole system is set up on the presumption that oil would only be $15 a barrel.
That's why you can get your raspberries from Chile any time of the year.
Because they used to cost nothing to ship them.
That's right. Not anymore. Well, we've been getting all kinds of responses today on the show. One, for instance, immediately came in after the top of the show. I like Peppy, says Bob K via email. Maybe you can change takeaway to all things Peppy. We'll have more of your maybe more negative feedback in a moment. And you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Or we want to know if you believe that there should be any restrictions on the internet. Is there any content that's just too vile that you believe should be regulated in some way? We want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Peppy.
what is the cost of regulating the internet? If you regulate one content, do you have to also regulate other content? It's a complicated question. We're going to be talking about that in just a moment. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
More headlines to come.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses 2 boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's June 12th, Thursday, and we have some headlines for you from Femi Oke. Good morning, Femi.
Hello, Adore. Just coming out to 27 minutes to the hour. Presidential candidates Barack Obama and John McCain go head-to-head on taxing and spending. Wildfires roar through parts of Northern California, displacing hundreds. And a devastating tornado hits a Boy Scout camp in Western Iowa, killing four. A British senior intelligence official has been suspended for leaving top secret papers on Al-Qaeda and Iraq on a commuter train. Authorities are investigating the incident, another black eye for the ruling Labour Party. Anti-war activists and hundreds of other demonstrators marched through the Italian capital today to protest President Bush's visit. President Bush didn't see the protesters. He meets with Italy's leaders today and with Pope Benedict tomorrow. Mr. Kim goes to Washington. South Korean Trade Minister Kim Jong-un travels to D.C. today. He's trying to rework a beef import deal that has sparked huge protests across South Korea. And finally, golf's U.S. Open begins in just a few hours. Tiger Woods is playing for the first time since undergoing knee surgery in April. Tiger says he's ready. Opponent Phil Mickelson says he doesn't doubt it.
He has come back from injury and won the first week back in the past. He has had huge layoffs and come back and won. He takes a bunch of time off before his tournament in L.A. there, and he comes out and he wins. I just don't see how it's going to have a negative effect on him.
Mickelson and Woods will play alongside each other in the first two rounds. That's the U.S. Golf Open starting in a few hours' time.
It'd be more interesting if Tiger Woods just blindfolded himself.
I think some of his rivals would wish that to happen.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
Also in the news today, a new plan to restrict online child pornography.
When it comes to child pornography, there is no excuse. There is no excuse that can justify it. There is no excuse that this office will tolerate. It has to be stopped.
That's New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo speaking on Tuesday about his plan to battle online child pornography. Cuomo has persuaded big-name internet service providers like Verizon, Sprint, and Time Warner in an unprecedented move to block child pornography. Joining us is Siva Vaidyanathan, an associate professor for media studies and law at the University of Virginia. Good morning, Siva. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, good morning. It's a pleasure.
Is this a good strategy?
It's a really important move. I mean, you know, child pornography is far and away the biggest problem on the internet. Most of the other problems that we hear about, things like copyright infringement, are either, you know, overreactions or simple moral panics. But child pornography, we're talking about real children getting hurt in real ways, and then a market developing around that to facilitate that and encourage that. So there really is no better example of how misbehavior and ickiness and horrible, destructive behavior gets perpetrated through the net. And it really only has two problems, this agreement between the Attorney General Cuomo's office and the internet service providers, two problems which can be summarized as, one, it won't work, so therefore it won't matter, and two, it affects content and communication far broader than child pornography. So it really misses its mark.
Okay, let's start with the first point you make. You say it won't work. Why?
Well, you have to remember that we're talking about users, consumers of child pornography and producers of child pornography. These people are obsessive, right? They're in this milieu because they're already sick, twisted, motivated. They already know they're shunned by most decent people in the world. They also are particularly adept at evading surveillance and evading any sort of attempts to block them. They've figured out long ago how to use strong encryption, how to use proxy servers, how to use all these techniques that this digital technology affords them to escape view. And basically all that this is going to do is force internet service providers to block entire groups of communication, what are known as Usenet groups. You might remember Usenet groups from back in the 20th century when people used to gather to have these sort of unregulated chats about certain subjects, whether it was the Ramones or Beverly Hills 90210, which was one of my favorite Usenet groups back in the day. Well, there are a whole lot of Usenet groups still active. And so we're not really talking about the World Wide Web as we know it. We're talking about sort of, you know, text and file distribution. And we're dealing with these internet service provider companies saying, look, New York State is asking us to do this, making us do this, and we're going to block access to lots of Usenet groups In fact, Time Warner wants to block access to Usenet in general. So we're talking about a very broad set of blockages. Now, the basic thing is, remember back in the 90s, we all used to plug phone lines into our computers and dial in to get our content. All that child pornographers have to do then is plug in the phone line and dial in. That's just one of many techniques.
But to your point that child pornographers are far ahead of policymakers or law enforcement, so then how does law enforcement and policymakers try to attack what you say, as you say, is an insidious problem?
Yeah, unfortunately, the old-fashioned way, with hard work and steady investigation and prosecution, et cetera. And that's not to say that any of those tactics work in a widespread way. We're probably not going to solve the child pornography problem this century, but by all means, let's do it in a way that recognizes the depth of the problem and the complexity of the problem. This is a major human flaw, a major human social flaw and psychological flaw, and one that has tremendous repercussions. Let's take it very seriously as a crime.
Right. Well, we're not going to solve the sort of human nature issue of child pornography, but who else is interested in these kinds of restrictions on the net? Should New York go ahead with this and it become a widespread phenomenon?
Well, you can see a lot of these efforts already being sort of modeled out in places like Saudi Arabia, which, of course, wants to block content far beyond child pornography. Any sort of nakedness or political dissent is blocked in similar ways in places like Saudi Arabia, in places like China. France has a much more subtle set of policies that are about to go in place that are very much like the New York policy. And, of course, they're very interested in restricting hate speech as well. So you see these efforts increasingly rolling out. And it's not to say that they're ineffective in the sense that they certainly make communication inconvenient. But remember, child pornographers are not dissuaded by inconvenience. And so what you have here is, I think, a dangerous situation where you're actually giving the impression that you're doing something about child pornography when, in fact, you're letting the problem fester and making it actually harder to investigate and prosecute the people who participate.
Thank you, Siva Vaidyanathan, an associate professor for media studies and law at the University of Virginia.
Food
for thought there.
Indeed. You know, we've got a very, very robust conversation going on our website today about our friend Stephen Dubner, another friend of ours, who talked about locavores, that is people who consume things only that are locally available to them. Mike Howell via our website says, why would you even buy a grocery store tomato these days? They're picked long before they're ripe so they can survive the long truck ride. They have negligible nutrition and they taste like wet cardboard. You can grow far superior tomatoes in your backyard for very little cash and not much effort. Again, an argument against what Stephen Dubner was saying.
And Super F88 says, if the goal here is to go low impact, we'd stay still and eat grass. Back to the landers, I know, grow food because no longer trust those creepy crops.
Anything on our website, and you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, everybody. Continuing with our discussion of our interactivity with our radio audience online, which you can get to us by contacting us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We thought we'd share with you some responses that bear on a fairly big issue. This is a brand new radio program, and public radio programs have very loyal audiences.
Absolutely.
And people have reacted to our presence with, shall we say, a certain amount of negativity that we'd like to share, because some of the comments give an insight to the nature of our audience, and we love the comments that we've been getting, and we want to share these in the spirit of extending the conversation. So some of you have identified quite astutely the incredible tension that goes on here in the studio between me and my co-host, Adora Udoji. Here's one.
John Hockenberry was so rude to Adora Udoji in criticizing the way you were pronouncing polygamy. And I just thought that it was nasty and condescending and really cheap. So I think you're covering important stories. I hope that you get rid of the horrible sound effects. Okay, thanks for listening to my comment.
Oh, there's some of those bad sound effects right there. Of course, we listened to all the comments. And that little exchange, we actually deliberately did that.
Yeah, but I don't think our plan went off too well.
I think we
didn't do such a good job in executing
that. A lot of your criticism involves the theme of how we butcher the English language.
Greg Jones here in South Dartmouth. Please, hurts my ears when I hear words like irregardless, because it's not really a word. It's regardless. Please, please, think of us in the morning. Bye.
Please tell Ada Ora that the idiom is comparing apples and oranges, not talking about apples and bananas. If you're going to use an idiom, please do so correctly.
I'm glad I don't have any of those problems.
But to Greg Jones in South Dartmouth, thank you very much. That's right. Irregardless is not a word, yeah. And I pledge not to say it again on
all
the
right,
show.
That's good. We'll hold you to that.
But one of our listeners thought the English language for you, John, was the least of your problems.
Please tell Han Jochenberry to stop saying going forward. It is a meaningless and stupid expression. No one thinks that you're talking about the past. Everyone knows that time moves forward. If you have to say anything, in the future was a perfectly acceptable phrase. There's no reason to ever say going forward. It makes you sound like a moron.
In the future, I'm going to try to sound less like a bleeping moron. Thank you so much for that. But the great thing is,
there is a takeaway point.
Yeah.
From that.
Yeah, and that is people are listening very closely to our show, and some are calling repeatedly.
I do not choose to give you my name, address, or phone number, as it is completely irrelevant. Ada Ora, I'm pronouncing your name the way it's spelled. If you want to pronounce your name Adora, that would be A-D-O-R-A.
Wait, what's she going with there?
There's actually a very quick story behind that. It's a Nigerian
quick.
Name.
Right.
It's not an unusual name. It means daughter of all, and it's usually only given to the child that's born first,
and
first as a
name.
Girl, and that's how they spell
and
it.
And it's your name. Other people gave us the similar kind of feedback, but they were much more polite.
I hate your show. I really am so disappointed that you're having takeaway. It's not useful, and I'm really disappointed. I hate it. You don't know what you're talking about, and it's really bad, especially in the morning when you wake up. Okay? Thank you. Bye-bye.
I just woke up to your show, and please bring back the other show that they had on. I think it was All Things Considered, whatever it was. I cannot take your show. It's just, you know, you guys are just too peppy.
Too peppy. Tragically peppy.
Tragically peppy. But
we
appreciate all of the comments, so keep sending them.
And
keep calling 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Thank you so much.
Too peppy.
Too peppy.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's June 12th, Thursday, and we have headlines from Femi Oke. Hi there, Femi.
Hello there, Adora. Coming up to 12 minutes to the hour. Just getting some news in on the economy from the Commerce Department. It reports that the retail sales soared up to 1% last month. That's the biggest increase since November, and a whole wide variety of retailers enjoyed a good month, including the biggest increase at department stores and other general merchandise stores in over a year. And not so good news from the Labour Department. They are reporting that the number of people filing new claims for unemployment benefits jumped last week to the highest level since March. So the new applications for jobless benefits rose to 384,000. And that's an increase of 25,000 from the previous week. As we head across to Cuba, Havana. Cuba's system of equal pay for all is going to be abolished. For the first time since the Cuban Revolution in 1959, it will be possible for workers to earn bonuses and no salaries will be capped. Michael Voss is the BBC correspondent in Havana, Cuba. Good morning, Michael. Hi there. Where did this news break?
Well, it was in the Communist Party newspaper yesterday, Granma, that the law was actually passed in February, but this is the first time that it's ever been mentioned in the newspapers. Basically, as you say, Fidel Castro wanted to create an egalitarian society with no huge contrast between rich and poor, and he tried to do this by paying everyone the same, but it's led to a really highly inefficient and unproductive economy, and the country's got huge import bills even before the world food and oil crisis hit. Until now, they used to blame it on the American embargo, but Raul Castro, the new president who's taken over from Fidel, is trying to put his own house in order and get the economy working, and he knows to do that, he's going to have to give people incentives. And one of those incentives is to pay people more for if they are productive.
Michael, thank you very much for that update. It's always great to hear from you. And whenever we need news from Cuba, we will come to you first. That's Michael Voss from the BBC reporting for us from Havana, Cuba. And most people in Cuba earn about $20 a month, and now they can have bonuses up to 30%. So it really will make a big difference to their monthly earnings.
It's an interesting picture on the character of reforms under Raul Castro.
Absolutely.
We're going to be seeing more like this, I think.
It just seems to be one reform after another. First, it was the cell phones. Then there is this issue of state employees being able to own property. It just makes you wonder what's coming next and what Cuba is going to look like in a year or more.
And this is all since
it's very
February.
Very measured, though, these reforms. Thank you very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
So we shift our focus now to a crisis that you may have missed. The European Union, one of the most powerful political institutions in the world, its very existence, its identity, the future of it may come down to a vote in Ireland taking place today. And the symbol of that vote, one way it could turn out, is a rubber turkey named Dustin. Yes, it's a symbol of, it's sort of a popular symbol. Some people have described it as if Stephen Colbert was a turkey, he'd be this character.
A turkey puppet.
Beloved turkey puppet. But actually, it's serious because Dustin, the turkey puppet, is part of the campaign to vote down an extraordinarily important reform package that is
not only affects
the
Ireland,
Union.
But affects all 27 countries in the European Union.
And the interesting thing about a measure of this type is in the European Union, these kinds of things work only if every member votes for it. So it has to be a unanimous vote. And today, the Irish are voting on whether to support this reform package. And the vote is too close to call. Fintan O'Toole is a columnist covering today's vote for the Irish Times. Is it possible that the EU's existence is coming down to this turkey, this turkey puppet who's, just like Stephen Colbert, who is apparently opposed to this reform package? And by the way, thanks for joining us, Fintan.
Good morning. No, the turkey is not going to have very much to do with it one way or the other. It was kind of used humorously that there's a thing called the Eurovision Song Contest, which is a pretty awful affair where different countries put in songs and people vote on them. And the turkey was Ireland's entry to the Eurovision Song Contest this year and did extremely badly, probably quite rightly. It was pretty awful. And some of the people campaigning against the EU reform treaty humorously put up a poster suggesting they didn't vote for us, so why should we vote for them?
But at this point, the vote is too close to call, and Ireland, which has benefited so mightily from participation in the EU, is really being told it's voting against its interest if this should go down, right?
Yeah, it's quite a strange situation in a way. I mean, what's happening is that, as you said in your introduction, every country has to pass this thing. There are 27 countries in the European Union now, but in only one of those countries do the people actually get to vote on it. Most of this has been ratified by governments. In Ireland, because of our constitution, it has to be done by the people. And so what's really happened is that you've suddenly asked 1% of the European Union population to make a really fairly complicated decision on behalf of 27 countries. And that involves people having to read a very dense legal text, which is about 287 pages.
287 pages?
But Fintan, is it more dense than Finnegan's Wake?
Well, I would love to be able to tell you that most Irish people can read Finnegan's Wake, but we don't understand it either. And the EU reform treaty is slightly more difficult than Finnegan's Wake, I think.
But what
that means really is that, you know, what it comes down to very often when you've got a document as complicated as that is that you get political leaders saying, trust us, we know this stuff, we negotiated it, it's good for us. The problem is that people in Ireland, just like people around most of the Western world, are not particularly enamored of their political leaders at the moment and are not particularly inclined to trust them. So when people come along and say, if you vote for this, you know, all sorts of horrible things are going to happen, they're almost more inclined to listen to those kind of negative voices than they are to reflect on their own experience. And I mean, you're absolutely right when you said, I mean, Ireland's experience of the European Union has been very, very good over the period since 1973 when we joined it. Ireland's been transformed from really a kind of economic backwater into a pretty wealthy, very, very prosperous country, and nobody doubts that the European Union was kind of critical to that happening. But there's a kind of funny effect of that. A lot of people say, well, okay, things are fine as they are. Why do we need to change them?
Yeah, and they have to trust their leaders if they're going to do it. Well, it's, you know, you've certainly unpacked some of the delicate psychology there in Ireland. And Dora, you have an actual EU passport.
I do.
That you're hoping
I'm
nothing
an
changes.
Irish citizen, yes, if you can believe
right,
that. And so I'm watching very closely, there. Fintan.
Well, Fintan, thanks.
You're very welcome, and we need more people. So.
Right.
Are you saying I should pack my bags?
Yeah. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to be doing the show from Ireland, actually, pretty good. So, Fintan, thank
I'm
you very much
that.
For joining us.
What? Talk to you.
And the door is packing. And Fintan O'Toole is columnist and editor with the Irish Times.
I'm busy right now. Well, I'm packing my bags.
I'm working with a foreigner here. A foreigner. Nigerian-Irish.
Nigerian-Irish.
A polyglot. Doesn't even begin to describe you.
Not really.
Yes, yeah. It's like I'm sitting here with the United Nations. It's like I'm in the General Assembly right now. So we've gotten some responses, so we want to play some of those in a minute. We asked you to, first of all, ask what kinds of restrictions you would want on the Internet. We'll talk about those in a moment. Certainly, a lot of you responded to some of the, shall we say, comeuppance audio that we shared with you a little earlier. Here's some responses.
Who is Adora Udoji? I think she's terrific, but I'd like a little bio. I know Mr. Hockenberry must have English roots, and he's great, too, but... I'm the president of the Adora Udoji fan club, whoever she is.
Whoa.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Whoever she is.
Good morning. This is Catherine Bellows calling from Exeter, Rhode Island. And I'm just calling to say that it took me a little while to get used to the show. Really do like it now. You know, it changes stuff for everyone, but it's a great show.
That's terrific.
I know, those were nice. It was
very nice
of people to pick up the phone and say, hey, we like what you're doing. And, you know, we're a new show, so we're finding our footing and we're trying a few things and we're experimenting.
And, it is jarring because, I mean, the competition on public radio in the morning is not as live as we are. It's a very different style of a show. And and a lot of people have reported that, you know, it's jarring when you hear it for the first time. But, you know, assuming that we keep our English usage correct, that I don't act like a bleeping moron. And that you don't say
that's
the word.
That's not bad advice.
Irregardless,
both
it
points.
Is.
Neither
it's
one of those
advice.
Are right. bad advice. Right. And to the first caller, who am I? I'm a longtime journalist. I'm a lawyer. I went to UCLA Law School. I worked for ABC News for many years, covering domestic
why are you
and
saying
foreign
this on
stories.
You should have a face-to-face meeting with the president.
I
of
just
the
thought
Adora
I'd give
Udoji
him a thumb, you know, a thumbnail sketch.
Great, great. Here's some more responses.
Abraham Alargon from Washington Heights, New York. I just want to say that it took me a little while getting used to your show, but I like it. I like your programming. I like your voices. I like your names. It's different.
That's great. Hockenberry, you don't.
Hi, my name is Craig. I'm calling in response to the rude callers that you receive every morning. I think you guys are doing a great job. Keep up the good work. I look forward to listening to your show. Have a great day, and I'll be there listening. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, the idea is not just to make us feel good. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want you to respond to this conversation. It's about a conversation
and
on the issues
the
that we do. Good and the bad.
And what did they used to call us, our producers here, Hakan Udoji? How come your name went first? Why did your name go first on that? Why
my original title for this program was Hell in a Handbasket.
Right.
That's right. You were.
And which one are
I don't
you,
know,
John?
It varies day to day. Thank you very much. It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.